Today, it's great to chat with Daniel Goleman on the podcast. Daniel is an internationally known psychologist who lectures frequently to professional groups, business audiences, and on college campuses. As a science journalist, Goleman reported on the brain and behavioral sciences for the New York Times for many years. His 1995 book, Emotional Intelligence, was on the New York Times bestseller list for a year and a half, with more than 5 million copies in print worldwide in 40 languages, and has been a bestseller in many countries. Apart from his books on emotional intelligence, Goleman has written books on topics including self-deception, creativity, transparency, meditation, social-emotional learning, eco-literacy, and the ecological crisis. Daniel, what an honor it is to chat with you today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
So this is a bit surreal for me, and I'll tell you why. When I was in ninth grade in high school, your book, Emotional Intelligence, came out. And when I just even read the first chapter, I thought to myself, this is what I'm going to do with my life someday.
Wow. And,
you know, that was the book that, you know, I wanted. First of all, when I said that's what I'm going to do with my life someday, there was a bunch of things tied up with that. I thought, wow, I want to be a science writer. It wasn't just, I want to be a psychologist. It was, I want to be a public science communicator. I want to do outreach. I just love the style and the way that you, it was very captivating. I remember, I think in chapter one or something, you talk about the amygdala and how it can be, you know, we can go berserk. And that's I thought, right. Wow, and it just made such an impact on me. So I just want to start off saying thank you for influencing me going into this field.
That's so kind of you. Yeah. I'm glad you followed that path.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
You seem to be, you're a psychologist and a communicator. That's great.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
I'm doing what I definitely dreamed of as a kid. So yeah, the note, we're going to talk about your work on mindfulness, maybe a little bit of social learning. I want to also know what eco-literacy means. Just real quick about emotional intelligence. Is this still a topic that you are you researching these days? Where's your mind at with emotional intelligence these days?
Well,
have you kind of moved on from it?
I'm doing several things right now. One is I'm writing an article for Harvard Business Review on the emotionally intelligent organization because for 25 years I've been a co-director of a consortium of researchers and practitioners around emotional intelligence in organizations. And there's so much data now that shows that this is a big factor in outstanding leaders, in high-performing teams, and we're making the argument at the organizational level for the first time. So that's something I'm still thinking about. Recently, I had a really vicious personal attack on me and the concept of emotional intelligence, kind of out of the blue, in the New Yorker, which got me thinking about it. And now I'm kind of rethinking emotional intelligence in terms of what's missing and what could be added. Maybe we can get back to that. I'm also writing a book with a Tibetan Lama on meditation.
Wow.
And that's been an interest of mine since my undergraduate days. So, I have many, many streams of interest, and those are several of them.
Wonderful. Yeah, let's talk a little about what might be missing from the idea of emotional intelligence. What sort of the central core things are still most valuable? I can start with some of my own sort of reading of the psychology literature. One thing I noticed was that when your book came out, you couldn't control the headlines, I'm sure. I think, you know, there was like a Time article headline was like, emotional intelligence is like 50,000 times more important than IQ or something like that. Yeah. Now, when I actually look into the literature, the literature shows, I mean, IQ in a lot of cases still outpredicts emotional intelligence if you do a regression model, you know, but it's certainly important. Have your views kind of changed at all? Or, you know, what are you thinking in terms of like comparing IQ versus EQ?
Well, first of all, I never made the claim that emotional intelligence always outperforms IQ. It's not true. Mm. Absolutely not true. But people, you know, you don't write the headlines.
That's what I said.
As you say.
Yeah. It's like the Time magazine cover. Yeah.
Yeah. Time. So editors hype ideas. They push them as far, you know, a little further than you want. I didn't even know that they're going to ask, what's your EQ? That was like the cover of Time. I had no idea. I don't even use EQ. I like EI for emotional intelligence. But anyway, when it comes to academics, to how well you do in school, to whether you'll be an outstanding professor. I think IQ is where it's at. I think emotional intelligence counts for very little there, except in terms of maybe of how you handle yourself. My model of emotional intelligence has two big parts. One is being aware of your feelings, then using that to manage your disruptive emotions and to marshal your better motivations and so on. And then empathy, tuning into people around you and using that to have effective relationships. So that's how I see it. So I would say that when it comes to the relationship sector or part of life, I would suspect that emotional intelligence probably outweighs IQ. I don't know that there are good studies yet that show that. One of the things you have to remember is IQ has been around for more than 100 years, and there's huge bodies of evidence around IQ. There have been several models proposed of IQ over the decades, and several measures that go with each of those models. And the same for emotional intelligence. You know, there are many models of emotional intelligence, many measures. So I would say the evidence is not yet in on many of the questions you raise. So if you were to do a statistical analysis, particularly if you use the first model of emotional intelligence, which was put forward by a friend of mine who's now the president of Yale, Peter Salovey. He was a junior professor at Yale at the time, and his graduate student then, John Mayer formerly. Their model is more like a personality model. It was based on intelligence. And if you use their measure solely, then you get one set of findings. If you use a model that I just explained to you, the four parts, self-awareness, self-management, empathy, social skill, and you use a measure I co-developed with Richard Boyatzis, who's at Case Western, you actually get a different picture. And it turns out if you're trying to predict performance in the workplace, our model's much better than the other model. But what I'm getting at is that it depends on what your outcome measure is as to whether IQ or emotional intelligence matters more.
Thank you. Yeah, this different models point is really interesting because I edited the Cambridge Handbook of Intelligence with Robert Sternberg, and we had a chapter in there on the latest research on emotional intelligence. And one of the biggest controversies in that chapter was this differentiation between emotional intelligence as an ability, a set of ability skills versus personality traits. I was surprised to hear you describe Salovey's model as personality because I always saw that as more ability-based and your model is more personality-based. Am I not thinking about that?
Yeah, I misspoke. I think his is explicitly an ability-based model.
Right.
What year was Sternberg writing that chapter?
Oh, no, Sternberg didn't write the chapter. Sternberg and I co-edited the entire book, the Cambridge Handbook of Intelligence.
You co-edited
I think
it actually, too.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was co-editor. Me and
What year was that?
2011.
Yeah.
I think the person who wrote the or one of the co-authors was Salovey, I believe, or Caruso or Meyer. One of them. Yeah. one of those guys.
Right.
Yeah,
Mesquite. So that was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
A lot has happened in the last 10 years. So if you were to look at emotional intelligence since 2011, you'd find that there are many new studies. So when I told you about the data point that my model with Boyatzis predicts performance in the workplace, leadership, better than the Mayer model, that's new finding. It wouldn't be in the book you edited.
Cool. Yeah. I'd love to read that study, very much so.
You know, the field is, it keeps moving, keeps developing.
Totally. And also, you know, a really interesting, nerdy question is like, what are the right proper boundary conditions for emotional intelligence? You know, if one includes too many, you know, positive personality traits under that umbrella, then it starts to lose its specificity. Where do you draw the line? There's no easy answer. Yeah.
Our model actually came from the work of our professor at Harvard, David McClelland, who was one of the people who developed the field called competency modeling, which you would not know about unless you're an IO psychologist, an organizational psychologist, because organizations want to know who are the most outstanding people in a given role in our organization. Who's best at sales? Who's best at software? What differentiates the stars, the top 10% performer by whatever metric makes sense for that role, from people who are only average. That gives you a competence model. And so we based our work on competence models, and we looked at which competencies seem to be nested in which of those four domains. That's how we came. So the boundary conditions were defined by that work. We cool. excluded purely cognitive abilities. And people who are not familiar with competence models can easily complain that it seems to include too much. But if you realize that we see four domains, self-awareness, self-management, empathy, and relationships, that's a lot of domains. And there's a lot of competencies that nest within them. And it makes sense from the organizational point of view to look at what are lumped together as soft skills as opposed to hard skills. And we're looking at soft skills in an orderly way, a systematic way. And we also looked at the behavioral level of those skills, something that's observable.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. It's really cool research that you're doing. What's always fascinating to me about is this bloody G factor, the general factor of intelligence. All these sure. abilities, if you try to measure them, they are all causally correlated with each other to a certain extent. And not to saying that there's no domain specificity, because there certainly is, but there is kind of an overarching G factor.
There is that. And Boyatzis just did an interesting study about that. He looked at engineers at a global manufacturing firm, and he asked them to rate other engineers on who's the most effective as an engineer. And he used the Raven as a measure of IQ. And he found that there was basically no correlation to effectiveness as an engineer with IQ, as rated by other engineers. And there was a rather high correlation, which I can't remember now, with emotional intelligence, as measured by our model. So that's a little counterintuitive, but I think it's because there's a floor effect for IQ in any profession. You've got to be pretty smart. I have a granddaughter who's studying engineering at Cornell right now. She's really smart. You got to be really smart to get an engineering degree, IQ-wise. However, to be the leader of a team of engineers, you're really managing people. And that doesn't depend on IQ. In fact, you need a minimal amount. You need to understand what it is they know so you can put the right person in the right place, for example. But, you know, it has to do with people skills, not with your IQ. So I would say that IQ gets you in the game, but it doesn't determine whether you'll be outstanding in that game.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah, and it depends what game you're playing, as you already mentioned.
Exactly. Yeah. If you're going to stay in academics, you're going to need every bit of IQ you can get.
Yeah. Does that count? Even in the humanities? No, I'm joking. everybody calm down.
You need your verbal fluency.
You need your verbal fluency.
That's part of IQ.
We should break down, you know, verbal versus nonverbal reasoning skills as well. Yeah. Okay. And just the only other thing I wanted to bring up about emotional intelligence before we move on was this idea that some people might think that if someone who's suffering or someone has an emotional outburst and one just says, oh, that person just needs more emotional intelligence, that might ignore a lot of societal factors and lack of support, and maybe that person's poor, maybe that person went through a lot of economic or environmental conditions. So I just want to give you a chance to address that.
I would say that understanding is true, but ignores another factor, which is called cognitive control. Cognitive control is an aspect that developmental psychologists are very familiar with. It means that you can widen the gap between impulse and reactivity. And the wider the gap, the more mature you can be, because you can consider other alternatives. So the person who, because of trauma in childhood, a disadvantaged childhood, or simply poor impulse control, does the first thing that comes to them, I'm not sure that excuses what they do. Let's say it's a cop who shoots someone while yelling taser. That happened like a week or two ago. Mm-hmm. This woman, who was a police officer, meant to subdue a non-cooperative suspect with her taser, grabbed her gun and shot him to death on the spot.
Yeah.
If she had had better cognitive control, she might have been able to use a less lethal intervention. So I would say that one of the factors, of course, is social, but there are other factors that have to do with how well you can manage your amygdala.
I guess the point there is that some people's might have a more uphill battle in managing their amygdala, maybe through mental illness or maybe through societal.
Well, that's true. Yes, I think so. One of the reasons I'm a big advocate of what's called social emotional learning, which is basically emotional intelligence for school kids from kindergarten to 12th grade, is that it, no matter where you grew up, no matter your zip code of origin, it teaches kids this same ability. And they did a study in New Zealand, very important study, where they measured cognitive control in kids 4 to 8 and then tracked them down in their 30s. They found that childhood cognitive control predicted income and health in your 30s better than childhood IQ, actually better than the wealth of the family you grew up in. And I went to a school in Spanish Harlem, very poor area of New York, where the kids are doing mindfulness, which we should get to, which it turns out enhances the circuitry for cognitive control, or seems to. And I was glad to see that because those kids are more calm and clear while they're in school, which means that they're going to learn more, which means that it may help them overcome the disadvantage of growing up in a housing project in Spanish Harlem.
That's super important work. My friend Josh Aronson runs the Mindful NYU lab, the Mindful Education Lab. I don't know if
you're wonderful.
Or in that lab, but I'd love to. Hope to maybe put you guys in touch with each other. So how did you become interested in studying mindfulness? And can you tell me a little bit about your work with Richard Davidson?
I got into meditation when I was an undergraduate because I was anxious and it helped me stay calm, calm me down. And then as a graduate student, I got a traveling fellowship to India where I got much more serious about studying meditation because as I met people who were, you would say, advanced meditators, yogis and lamas and swamis, I noticed that they seemed to share certain traits or characteristics that I found very interesting. They're pretty calm. They're joyful. They seem to be loving. They all seem to be positive human attributes. So, you know, I went back to Harvard after the fellowship. I said, you know, I want to do my dissertation on meditation and stress. And they said, that's the stupidest idea we've ever heard.
Really?
Yeah, this was way too early. In fact,
I bet they're kicking themselves now.
They may not be alive now, actually. But anyway. Yeah. So another graduate student at the time, Richard Davidson, also wanted to do research on meditation. He was told that that would be a career-ending move, but we went ahead and did it anyway. Mm. And Richie, as everybody calls him, and I are very old friends. He now heads a neuroscience lab at University of Wisconsin. And we circled around and looked at the more than 6,000 peer-reviewed articles on meditation and mindfulness. Mindfulness is one kind of meditation. There are many kinds. And most research these days is on mindfulness because of another friend of ours from those days in Cambridge, a guy named John Kabat-Zinn, who developed mindfulness-based stress reduction when he was at UMass Medical Center. And that is manualized, which means that people can replicate the methodology that they use to teach it, and it makes it very researchable. So it's been lots of research on that. And basically, the research shows that pretty much from the beginning, people do become more calm, as measured by all kinds of things, including physiology. They become more focused. Their ability to focus attention improves. Working memory seems to improve, as indicated by better test scores in students. And if you do an aspect of mindfulness, which is called loving kindness practice, which enhances warm-heartedness, you actually become more generous, more kind, as measured by, you know, the kinds of measures you use in a peer review article. So the benefits seem to show up from the beginning. We did three tranches. One is we looked at beginning meditators, 1 to 100 hours, lifetime hours of meditation. Wow. We looked at long-term practitioners, which is 1,000 to 10,000 hours lifetime. And then we looked at Olympic level, 12,000 to 62,000 hours. Those were Tibetan yogis or yogis from Europe who were flown over to his lab one by one for brain measures. And at that level, he found that their brains are functionally different.
Hmm. You see, I have my yoga and my meditation, so you know,
your mat here.
Yeah, whatever it's called. I couldn't even remember what the heck it's called. But my cushion, that's the word I was looking for, my cushion. meditation has helped me many times in my life when I've had, when I keep thinking about going on an SSRI. I keep meditating and then realize I don't necessarily need to at that moment.
Yeah. You know, they might be good together. Who knows?
Yeah. For some people, that can work. Sure.
And then there are some studies that seem to show that many people can get off meds, like for depression or anxiety, if they introduce a regular meditation practice.
Yeah.
But I think it's quite individual.
Quite individual, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. This actually makes me think of some questions, the individual part. Do you think there's a certain kind of personality that's attracted to mindfulness to begin with? Like, I know mindfulness can change your personality, but do you think, like, if you do a pretest, there's like a certain kind of person that finds the whole meditation business more interesting anyway than a different type of personality?
You know, that's the kind of question that calls for a graduate student
who's looking for a thesis topic. Yeah.
Because it's a wonderful question, and I don't think it's been answered. At least I haven't seen the answer myself. Do you have a hunch?
I do have a hunch. I do. Because I've noticed that there's a certain like phenotype among mindfulness researchers the point here is that I don't know if it's because it's an outcome of their long time meditation or if what was there existing beforehand.
You need a randomized control trial.
Yeah.
Where people who are equally interested are randomly assigned to meditate or, and this is very important, to an active control group, something that the teachers are equally enthusiastic about and positive about. When Davidson did that with MBSR, he put together HEP, Health Enhancement Program. And the teachers of HEP were as positive that it would help you as were the teachers of mindfulness. And this is interesting. All subjective outcome measures fell away. There was no difference. It was in the physiological that you found the difference.
Wow, that's so interesting. What is that paper if I wanted to look it up? Not to put you on the spot.
I don't know, but it must be on Davidson's homepage.
Okay, I'm sure I can. Yeah. Find it. I mean, he's so many publications.
And maybe co-authored with Kabat-Zinn.
Okay.
If they published the findings.
Okay.
I don't even know if they did. Yeah.
Maybe not. What does the data show about the relationship between neuroplasticity and mindfulness?
It seems what I'm familiar with, and there may be much more, is that the consistent mind training that you get if you practice mindfulness of the breath, for example, where there are, you know, four basic moves. You put your mind on your breath, it wanders off, you notice it wandered, and you bring it back to the breath. I suspect that the payoff is in bringing it back to the breath, and that strengthens connectivity for neural circuitry involved in focus and ignoring distraction.
Yeah.
That would be my hypothesis.
Quite possibly, yeah. Yeah. You know, there's all sorts of different meditations that exist, returning to the breath being one of them. I'm really into open monitoring meditation. I was wondering if what your thoughts are on different forms of meditation. Are there any that are more conducive to creativity in your view than others? Where do you see creativity fitting to this picture?
Well, you know, the classic model of creativity has three stages. One is curiosity. You know, you absorb as much information on the subject as you can. You struggle to solve the problem. You can't solve it. And you forget about it. That's the second stage. So it's kind of, you know, it's the default mode network, DMN, which is the part of the brain, the circuitry that comes online when you're not focused on a task, for example. Mm-hmm. And during that mode, I think that people make connections much more effectively and widely than they do when they're task-focused. Because when you're task-focused, you see mind-wandering as a distraction. So it's during that second stage when you would get more creative insight. And then third is you execute. So you have to go back to your focused. So I think that a meditation that left you wide open would be very good, particularly if thoughts keep coming up, but then you drop them. Every once in a while, you get a really good one. You'll probably write that one down. That's your creative insight.
I really like what you're saying, and I really like that level of nuance. As creativity, you know, is involved lots of different stages. It's cyclical. You know, you have to go back and forth between different modes of thought. The mindful state might not be uniformly be the best state for creativity 24/7. You know, like, would you want to be in the mindful state 24/7, Daniel Goleman?
It depends what you mean by mindful.
Yeah, fair enough. In the controlled return to breath, the kind of mental state.
Okay, I told you I'm writing a book with this Tibetan Lama. Mm-hmm. So they have a different model of mindfulness. So one of the ways they use mindfulness is to just what you said. To notice when your mind wanders and bring it back. Mm. That's called mindfulness with support. Then there's mindfulness without support, where you go in. What did you say you do? Open
monitoring.
Open monitoring. That might be the second, where you let whatever comes up come up, but you don't follow it.
Right.
And the mindfulness is to be sure you don't follow it. You don't get sucked into some thought or some sensation. Or some perception, you let it come, you let it go. The third level in the Tibetan model is way beyond anything that we call mindfulness in the West, because they see any thought or perception that traps you in any way as a distraction. And they use mindfulness to see that that doesn't happen. And in fact, their goal is to be in that state 24/7.
That's so interesting. Can you give me an example of like when I'm trapped in a thought? Like, is it sort of like when it's repetitive or ruminative? Is that the idea?
Oh, no. It's simply when one thought leads to another and another. When there's a train of thought that started with that one innocent thought. Oh, yeah, I didn't pay my rent. And then I start thinking about the balance in my checkbook. And then I think about the other bills I have to on and on and on. And you're not meditating, you're lost in thought. And you may not notice it. But then if you notice it, think, oh, I better go back to my breath. That's the moment of mindfulness.
I'm reminded of this phrase, not all minds that wander are lost. isn't it like creativity sometimes requires going down some alleys and then letting an insight emerge and then being aware of the insight. I suppose it's no good if you're not aware of all the goodies, you know, and gold that's coming out of your consciousness. That's not good, but
you know, there's another thing going on here, which I'd like to call out, which is that the cultural context from which mindfulness is derived didn't care in the least about you being creative or you getting higher performance. Mm. Those are like side benefits. The West, however, seized on those. So we want to be mindful so we can be calm. We want to be mindful so we can be clear in our thinking. We want to be mindful so we can perform better. That's a Western point of view. the Eastern point of view had a far different goal in mind. And as it happened, these were side effects of that process.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so true. I wrote an article for Scientific American on spiritual narcissism. This idea that some people who meditate more than others start to think they're superior to others, the I'm enlightened and you're not effect. But that really does miss the point of meditation big time, which is being very aware.
There's another irony or paradox there too, which I don't know if you're aware of. If you're in an Asian culture, like say Tibet, someone who actually is enlightened would never say they were enlightened because humility is part of what gets you there. And if you say, you know, hey, you know, I'm pretty special, like a narcissist would, it means, you know, you're not really special at all.
For sure. And well, here's the thing. The more I meditate, the more I realize just how not special I am.
Oh, that's interesting.
and not only that, but I realize just how crazy I am in the sense of my consciousness. I mean, I sit there and I you know, just become a witness to my consciousness in such a way that I don't identify with my thoughts, that I'm like, wow, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on there.
You can think anything. And from, you know, in the Asian model, it doesn't matter what you think. It's really the process, not the content, that's interesting. And from a Western point of view, you know, I don't know if you've noticed this, but people who start to meditate sometimes say, oh man, I could never do this. My mind is going nuts. It's just one thought after another, which actually is a good sign because it means you're starting to notice how things are in there.
Yeah, I think that's quite right. That's quite right. Well, what do you think about these apps? You know, like Headspace and Calm, waking up. Do you think they're as effective as long-term meditation training and retreats that are not app-based?
Well, Davidson and I made a distinction between going wide with meditation and going deep. And I think apps allow going wide. It means more people can get the benefits, particularly the beginning level benefits from meditation than otherwise would. Whether an app is as effective as an in-person teacher, I suspect not, but I don't know of a study that shows it. I suspect not, because a teacher can answer your questions and help you stay on track. And an app may not be as good at that. I don't know. I've never used an app. The deep, however, doesn't happen with an app. The deep means you follow a path to a traditional path to its traditional end. And that takes a lot of practice. As I said, 12,000 to 62,000 hours is the group that Davidson looked at. That's if you do a traditional Tibetan retreat, which is 3 years, 3 months, 3 days, you get credit for 10,000 hours. Mm. So 62,000 hours is a heck of a lot of practice.
That'll really get your prefrontal cortex tuned up.
When they did a study with the guy at 62,000 hours, they asked him to do a meditation on compassion, and there's certain neurocircuitry that activates. His activated instantly about 700 or 800 times more than it had been, which has actually never been seen before.
That's
to
incredible.
Voluntarily make a change like that in the brain. So the brains are functionally different.
They actually scanned his brain like day one?
fMRI, yeah.
fMRI. So they actually had that comparison. Wow,
yeah,
that's a cool study. That's
PNAs.
A really cool study.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you brought up compassion, because one of, you know, there's a lot of touted benefits of mindfulness, and some of them have not borne out. You know, like some people that like sell meditation programs will claim all sorts of things: better sex, you know, it'll make you won't lose your hair.
That's,
you know,
it's called good old American marketing. Of course.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but one of the benefits that I sometimes see touted, which I actually haven't seen good evidence for, is that mindfulness will improve your like emotional intelligence, your social intelligence. And I haven't seen that evidence that that is the case. With compassion, yes, but not in terms of social skills. So I was wondering like what you think the relationship is between mindfulness and emotional and social intelligence.
Let's back up a minute, because I said in passing that mindfulness is one of many, many varieties of meditation.
That's a good
point. So I think that you want to see what is the intervention And then what's the outcome measure you're looking for with that intervention? So there may be a meditation or set of meditations which does make you more interpersonal. I ran into a fellow who's a Sufi. Sufis have their own set of practices. This guy was so loving. I was just blown away. Wow. Whether it's his personality or due to practice, I don't know. But I suspect it, practice was a large part of it. But they don't do what we think of as mindfulness of the breath. They do other kinds of spiritual practice. And it has a different kind of payoff. And I think the fact that he was so loving probably made him more effective in relationship. Probably. We don't know. But all I'm saying is that I think a more sophisticated way of asking the question is, does intervention X, a certain kind of meditation, have outcome Y? And I wouldn't expect that any one intervention would improve all four domains of emotional intelligence. There may be a set, but a good point. Seen it.
But one could make the hypothesis that sitting there, isolated meditation, in your own thoughts, can actually make you disconnected from people when you get out of it. You know, in the sense it makes it more awkward, like talking to people, because you've been so focused on your own thoughts for so long. I mean, one could make
you
that.
You could
case.
Say that. The counter hypothesis would be that tuning into the full range of your own emotion might help you be more empathic in tuning into the emotions of other people. So one of the findings I remember on empathy, and I don't remember the source, is that if you're tuned out of a range of your own inner experience, you will have trouble picking that up in other people. So you could make a counter hypothesis just as easily. So since you're an empirically oriented guy, I would say we have to wait and see until we get graduate students.
Is that a nice way of saying, since you're an uber nerd, Scott?
I think it's a way of saying you want to see what the data says. And just as with emotional intelligence, meditation actually is a very young field for research. When Davidson and I looked at the studies, I think I mentioned there were three peer review studies, maybe two, and they're both anecdotal when we did our dissertations. And now there are more than 6,000 in peer-reviewed journals. Many of them not that good, by the way. So it's a new field.
It's many new. Many questions, and there is some data. I mean, I had David Vago on my podcast. I don't know if you've been following his research on mindfulness, V-A-G-O. What do you say? You know him?
I know David.
Yeah. Oh, good, good. He's such a good guy. I really like him. He wrote, a critical review of it was called the Mindfulness Hype, I think was the title. And when I talked to him on his podcast, on my podcast, he made clear that there is no data showing that it does improve your social skills or your even ability to listen to people. Just so much we still need to know and to see what and separate the hype from the myth.
You know, I think if I wanted to improve someone's ability to listen, I would train them in a listening method. Come on. I feel that mindfulness probably is overhyped and that expectations may be too high, that they think this may be the answer to everything because perhaps it's sold that way. I don't think it is. It might be an answer to some things, but not everything.
Yeah. No, that's a great answer. And also just like, I can practice mindfulness without an app just by living my life. For instance, right now there is this nonstop noise of a jackhammer construction that I couldn't control, and I am trying so hard to aren't I practicing my mindfulness muscles right now? Doesn't that count? Does it count?
You're certainly practicing your behavioral inhibition muscles.
Okay.
And cognitive control. Congratulations.
Yay.
You're doing great.
I mean, I'm trying to stay mindful to the conversation, despite all these things.
By mindful there, you mean focused.
Focused, yeah.
Attentive. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've talked to Michi Jha. She's an attention researcher.
No.
J-H-A. No. I recommend her. I just did an interview with her. She is at University of Miami.
Okay.
And she looks at the various modalities of attention in terms of mindfulness training. You might find it interesting.
Now,
and she
you're
has
not
a book coming out. Pardon me?
Oh, you're not talking about Preeti Shah, are you?
No. Mishi Jha.
Mishi Jha. I like Preeti Shah as well, who studies different... I'm not even joking. Preeti Shah fractionates executive functioning to different components as well. So I thought you were talking about her work. But yeah,
interesting.
But I'll check out this person you're referring to for sure. What's her new book called? Do you know the name of
it? Peak Mind. It won't be out until fall.
Very nice. So what do you think the future of mindfulness training methods should be like? What's on the horizon in terms of new and exciting methods to help people train their mind to be more mindful?
I would broaden the question. I would say, what mind training methods might be coming down the pike that would be a benefit? Mindfulness is one variety of training the mind. Visualization is another traditional one. So I think that what we have learned at a higher level is that trainings like mindfulness seem to make neuroplasticity more systematic so that we can drive the brain, change the brain in desirable ways. And I suspect that with time, people will develop more and more methods, mindfulness being one of many, and maybe mindfulness being a part of many, to help people develop mental capacities. Just the way you go to a gym and a trainer takes you through, you want to develop your abs or your pecs or something. Do this, do that. I suspect that mind training will follow those lines and become more specific to the desired outcome. Is that a development that I think is good? In a relative way, I think it's good. In another way, I think it kind of sucks because it distracts people from the traditional inner goals or spiritual goals of the traditions that mindfulness and other meditation mind trainings have come from. And I feel that in the future, those goals, things like caring more about the greater good than your own self-interest, will become more and more important for the survival of the species. So in a way, it's good. And in a way, it's not enough.
Well, that was a very sophisticated reframing of my question and a very sophisticated answer. So thank you. Thank you for doing that. I think this relates as well to what you mean by, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you often make the distinction between practicing smart versus just practicing 10,000 hours, right?
Yes. So one of the advantages that people who are in that top category have is that they have a trainer, they have a coach, a teacher who monitors how they're doing and gives them correctives, which helps them practice smart. And this comes from the work of Erickson at Florida, who the silly 10,000 hour rule came from his research. He's miffed about that because he finds there's a dose response relationship between training and outcome, and that it varies from skill to skill. So if you're doing memory, for example, it's a matter of hundreds of hours, not 10,000 hours.
Oh, it's okay. I see you have his book right behind you. Peak. I see right in your bookshelf right there.
Yeah.
Right there.
That's right.
He was a friend of mine. You know, he passed away recently, right?
No, I didn't know that. Oh, I'm so sorry to hear.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, that's a loss.
Yeah. It was a real big loss.
He did great work on mastery in any domain. He was a real wonderful person. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a friend and a sparring partner because I thought he neglected the role of talent. And anyway, he was always such a delight in even just discussing these things. Like he didn't have that big of an ego. Yeah.
So how did you get into doing what you're doing? You don't need to put this in the podcast. I'm just interested. Where did you go to undergrad and all of that?
Well, I did my undergrad at Carnegie Mellon University.
Oh, you did?
But I did my PhD at Yale with Robert Sternberg. And
happened to edit that book with him?
Yeah, we worked on a bunch of other things as well. But but yeah, I remember Salovey was there as well. That's at, you know, that he wasn't head of Yale yet. He was still working in the psychology department.
Sure.
And but even when I was in grad school, I thought to myself, I really want to do popular writing. So I started a blog for Psychology Today, which ended up doing really well. And good. And realized I had a knack for popular science writing, and it was in my bones. So I've been doing a lot more of that. Now I write regularly for Scientific American, and I write books. I'd love to send you my most recent book on transcendence, the science of transcendence.
Really, the science of transcendence. That sounds intriguing. Yeah. By the way, can you put my podcast in your show notes?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I just started a podcast called First Person Plural.
Okay.
And it's emotional intelligence and beyond. It's all kinds of things that I'm interested in.
Okay. In this new book or podcast, sorry, in this new podcast, do you talk about eco-literacy and the ecological crisis? Because I'm so curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yes. I just did a podcast on that because one of the things that troubles me is that at the systems level, in the economic system, we have complete transparency about value of stocks, for example, or companies. We have zero transparency about the environmental impacts of things we buy and use, the things that are sold to us. And my argument is that since there is now a methodology to assess a range of environmental impacts, it's called life cycle assessment, that consumers and businesses and B2B should be given a third-party evaluation of a product or process's impact on the environment. Is it good for the environment, bad for the environment, or terrible for the environment? So that we could create a market force that would move things in a better direction. And this is already happening in the investment community, by the way. My next-door neighbor is just becoming head of a $2 billion fund for sustainable investing at a very large financial firm. And there's a whole movement in the investment world to put their money, particularly investors who are interested in long-term return, like pension funds and so on, put their money in companies that already are paying attention to this. So it's already started, but in my writing, I did a book called Ecological Intelligence, and I make the argument I just summarized for you. It's something that I continue to worry about. So I did a podcast in first person plural, talking to someone who is developing a platform where companies can share this data on their impacts, and someone who's doing regenerative farming, which is a way of doing agriculture that doesn't destroy the soil. And so I'm a little passionate about this. I have grandchildren.
Yeah. You know, that wasn't in Howard Gardner's, you know, he didn't have ecological intelligence. So that's one, that's you added that one. Was that you?
yeah, they wanted that title for the book. I wanted to call it Radical Transparency, but it doesn't matter.
Ooh. Radical transparency. I think ecological intelligence probably is better from a marketing perspective.
That's what my editor thought.
But I mean, my gosh, you look at your whole career, you know, that word intelligence has played such a prominent, you know, sort of presence in as a thread in all of your stuff, a lot of your stuff. What do you think like how would you even define the word intelligence? It's funny because I'm asking that as the last question. I should have asked that probably as the first question.
Yeah.
But you know, if you're gonna use the word intelligence at the end of a lot of these things, what makes them all in intelligence? You know what I mean? Is that a fair question?
I don't know. Let me see. See what I come up with.
Yeah.
So I guess intelligence is a way of referring to a person's capacity or ability to solve problems in a given domain. Mm-hmm. So in the verbal and spatial and mathematical domain, we have IQ. In the interpersonal and intrapersonal domain, We have emotional intelligence. And why not in the environmental domain, ecological intelligence? And I'm sure there are others.
What's the difference between, what's the difference between emotional and social intelligence?
People differ in their opinions on this. Social intelligence, some say, refers to your relationship skills and empathy. Some say emotional intelligence refers to your intrapersonal abilities, your self-awareness and your self-management skills. I happen to lump them both together under emotional intelligence. My colleague, Richard Boyatzis, separates them into two skill sets. There's a long tradition of research on social intelligence. Yeah. And a nascent body of work on emotional intelligence as defined narrowly.
But you wrote a whole book on social intelligence, which I really enjoyed, which was separate from emotional. So, yeah.
Right.
So do you see, a thread running through all of your work? Like, what would you say it is? I was trying to put words in your mouth by saying intelligence, but what would you say it is? If you had to reflect on the tie that binds all of it.
Yeah. Probably what interests me right now.
Hmm.
And that's a moving target.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. What interests you at that time?
Yeah. At that given moment. Yeah. Yeah. So, so for example, Social Intelligence is a book that was monitoring the emergence of social neuroscience. And I thought, hey, there's a critical mass of findings about the basis for relationship and interactions. There's enough to write a book about. And I wrote a book about it. It interested me.
So right now, May 11th, 2021, what are you most excited about? And what are you kind of looking forward to working on? What projects?
Oh, so I'm rethinking emotional intelligence. In
really?
Terms of
cool.
What's good, what's not so good, what's missing. What other abilities might turbocharge it. I'm interested, ongoing interested in meditation. Mostly those, yeah.
Hey, that's good enough, Daniel. I want to thank you so much for, I know it was hard for us to hear each other. We're kind of sign languaging over here, but we made it through and I'm really happy that we got a chance to finally talk. Thank you so much, Daniel, for being on the
podcast. Please send me your book on transcendence. I'm really interested in that.
I sure will. I'll reach out an email. You can give me your address. That'd be great.
Great.
Okay. Thanks, Daniel.
This has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Likewise.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, if you'd prefer a completely ad-free experience and would like early access to new episodes, you can join us at patreon.com/psychpodcast. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.